Page 114 of The Unfolding is the story of Monty Gannon and Michael Smith.
I'm telling these guys, and I'm trying to keep it together. I said, this pastor of this church just, you know, offered me forgiveness and wants to try to change my life. I was like, maybe there is a God. I mean, who does that?
God's story has been unfolding
since the beginning of time.
He invites you to be a part of it.
Another page in The Unfolding.
Hey, this is Meredith Foster. Every week on The Unfolding, we share a God story, how God uses the events and experiences of our lives to transform our faith. When I first heard about this week's story, I thought, that is so incredible. There's no other explanation but God. When you've heard it, I think you're going to feel the same. Monty Gannon is a pastor. His church experienced something awful. As Monty was grappling with this turn of events, he sensed God saying, you know, this looks terrible, but I'm about to do something beautiful. This is a story of God taking what was meant for evil and using it for good. Mind-blowing, life-changing good. In order to understand where you were when this incident happened, I'd love to hear a little background about where your faith was and what were you like?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even before I was in ministry, I mean, just to give you a context of where I was with Christ, 18 years old, I went to college and I was kind of done with church, not because I just didn't see the value in it. Fast forward, I got married, had a family, but no relationship really with Jesus, and always had a party lifestyle. I mean, I drank from 14, you know, on to like my mid-20s, and got married in my 20s and, you know, got introduced to drugs and never dreamed. I mean, I had a great job. My wife did, you know, just this white-collar family living in suburbia, and just got hooked on drugs and hid it from my wife, hid it from my family, hid it from my friends, and actually functioned like that for 3 years in my marriage.
Wow.
Yeah. I always say it's not good to be a functioning addict because it just prolongs the agony.
Yeah.
You know, my wife's thinking, what's wrong with our marriage? What's wrong with, why are we so dysfunctional? We're going to counselors and I'm just playing the game, you know, lying to counselors, lying to everybody. But living a double life, you know, all I did was look forward to getting high. And even that towards the end was miserable. You know, I remember one moment was pivotal. I'm in my closet. It's dark. And I'm towards the end. I'm not getting busted. I'm functioning as this addict, but I'm miserable. And I'm kneeling in this walk-in closet. Just picture that. And I have these drugs in my hand. And I'm literally crying out to God. I'm like, God, I'm freaking dying here. Like, I would give anything not to do what I have right now. But I knew I had no choice. Like, I was a slave. I mean, there was no option. And I was, like, kind of yelling at God. I'm like, but I don't have a choice, do I? And I'm just waiting for God to intervene, you know, some sort of a miracle to take it away from me. And God done praying that prayer and did all the drugs. That was, like, that was my lunch hour for work, by the way. You know, I'd go home. Uh-huh. I mean, this is lunch. And it was just insanity. And one day I'm driving down 41st Street in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, sobbing. I was a shell of a man. I mean, I don't know how a corpse can drive a car, but it was happening that day. And I went home and I told my wife, I just told her, here's what's going on. And
you fessed up to all of it?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. I couldn't do it anymore. I could not do it. I was doing a lot of drugs every day and I was going to die. I mean, I was already dead internally, spiritually. And I told my wife, and I kid you not, the look on her face, it was like someone just punched her in the gut. She was so devastated. I mean, she made a comment, you know, if it was an affair or something, that would have been better because she can look at the person and see the person, kind of get it. But she said, you'd throw it all away for that? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, I would. That's how psychotic this addiction was. So I went to rehab twice. First time, I just wanted to say, my family, start using right away again. Second time, it was gut check time. Either I'm going to stop or I'm going to die. And after the second rehab, I knew I needed God. So my wife and I got invited to a church. And we went, it was nothing like I'd ever experienced. Like, it was just different. And, you know, people were like, I was messed up. I was just messed up. And they were welcoming me. They were loving me. And I'm like, man, if they knew me, they probably wouldn't be so kind and welcoming. But the more they got to know me and the more they got to know how messed up I was, the more they pressed in. And so my conversion, it sounds kind of religious, but this is what went down. I was sitting at church 6 months into it probably and still staying sober, but miserable, trying to just live this life in sobriety. And I don't know what the pastor was saying. I have no idea. And this is a large church. There's probably 600 people in the room. We're sitting towards the back. And there's these pictures of Christ on the cross from The Passion of the Christ, that movie. I remember looking at Christ. He's butchered and bloody. And I'm like, and I've never doubted the resurrection. I've never doubted Jesus. I've always believed, but I wasn't following. And I think that's a big difference. Like, I believed in Jesus all my life, but I'm telling you, what do they say? Even the devil believes, even the demons believe. I believed. I wasn't surrendered. I wasn't sold out. I wasn't following. And that day when I saw Jesus, I remember feeling so worthless. I'm sobbing in my chair. And my wife's like, she knew I was a wreck. And I'm like, I don't get it. Why would this guy, why would he go through that for me? I'm worthless. Like, I am worthless. I'm sober, but I'm miserable. My family's miserable. And I stood up right in church. My Bible falls off my lap. And here, I said it twice audibly. I said, I'll give my life to this. And then I said it again out loud. I'll give my life to this. I had no idea what it meant. None. It was just coming out of my mouth. And my wife is like, looking at me. She's like, what is my crazy husband doing now? He's standing up. Everybody else is sitting. And she's like, sit down, sit down. I'm like, and I just stood there. And after I said it twice, I sat back down and she has no idea what's going on. She's thinking, my God, who knows what he's thinking now? And at that moment, it wasn't like I was different right away, but something happened.
Something
and I
changed.
Immediately contacted the church. I said, I'm supposed to do something. And they start get me serving in the kids ministry and I'm giving my life away every week. Life change started to happen. And my recovery went from like AA meetings, which were very valuable to me, but it went from that to adding church to it and adding the Lord to it and adding Christ to it. It was still not easy. It was still a road that was difficult. But in that, that's really what happened for me. I went from the head knowledge in religion to the heart relationship in Christ. I had no idea what it meant. But that day I started following. To fast forward from there, I was in that church serving methodically for 3 years. Man, you couldn't get me away from it. My goal wasn't ministry or full-time ministry. That wasn't my goal. I'm going to be a pastor. My job kept me on through two rehabs. I'm like, I'll be a witness in the world. I'll work. It'll be good. 3 years later, they asked me to come on staff. They're launching a church across town, a campus across town, wanted me to be in charge of kids ministry. I said, yes, I'll do it. And then a year into that, they asked me to be the campus pastor. And I'm like, I'm not a pastor. I don't know what I'm doing.
Wow.
So I start going to school. They sent me to school to Oklahoma Wesleyan University to get my degree in ministry and leadership. So I'm leading a campus and I'm going to church to be, or going to school to be a pastor. And it's just insane what God is doing. Wow. Fast forward, the campus grew like crazy. It grew from 200 to 900 people in 2 years. And I mean, it's thriving. It's great. But yet God is pulling on my heart. I'm supposed to, because this is the campus where I'm like the campus pastor, but God's calling me to lead larger and to lead a church. And I didn't know what that meant. And without going through all the details, I'm like, I think I told my wife, Jody, I said, I think we're supposed to start a church. And I thought it'd be in Sioux Falls where we were from. Through a bunch of circumstances, prayer, nothing that was a coincidence, we end up in Omaha, Nebraska. And I never, like if you would have asked me 4.5 years ago,
right,
it was not on the radar. It was on God's, not mine.
Oh.
So our family moved to Omaha in what, May of 2017. 10 adults came with us. So 10 adults, 12, including my wife and I, 8 kids. So 20 total people moved to start what we call Meadows Church. We launched in October 2017, you know, and it was great. We launched at a convention center, kind of a Courtyard Marriott convention center in Bellevue, Nebraska. And it was 2 years. We were 2 years into it. God was doing great things. We're a portable church in a trailer. You know what I'm saying? So
how does that work? Like you literally load every Sunday, you unload at the convention center,
yes,
set up, and then you load all your stuff back into a trailer.
Yes, it is work. We're there at 6:30 in the morning every Sunday. The team is there. We unload production equipment, speakers, kids ministry stuff, guest services, gifts, everything that you would have in part of a church. We shove it in a trailer. We unpack it that morning. We do church. We're doing two services. Second service is done. We pack it back up. So, you know, by about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, we're done.
Wow.
And it's all volunteers, you know, from 6:30 in the morning till 2, doing church, loving people, reaching people, leading people to Christ and their God-given purpose. That's our mission. And we just came to reach people that, that were like me. I mean, people that were desperate and broken, people that were hurting and dying. And it was going really well. I mean, it's work, but that's the church. Mm-hmm. But God was on the move. And then out of the blue on a Thursday night, this is what really kind of rocked us. A police officer shows up at my door and he says, do you own a trailer? And my first thought was, no, I don't. And he said, Meadows Church. And I said, oh, our church trailer. I said, yeah, it's parked at the event center where we always park it. And he said, well, it's on fire in Council Bluffs. I was just like, I was kind of surreal. I'm like, on fire in Council Bluffs? I said, what? He said, yeah, obviously someone has taken it and, you know, it's on fire. And I'm like, and my mind's just racing. It's Thursday. We got to do church on Sunday. Oh, I'm like, wow. Okay, that's everything we have. You know, a church plant doesn't have a huge budget. You know, we don't have a lot of resources. That was it. So immediately I call some of my leaders. I tell them what's going on. Get this. I call my church that I got saved at in Sioux Falls. Here's the power of networks and the power of community and relationship. My church, they put together a trailer of stuff and they have it down there in 2 days. And that was insane. So before that, that happened on Friday, I called my pastor. But even before I called him, that next day, we go out to inspect the trailer. It's at a tow yard in Council Bluffs. And we do a video. I knew. I just had this feeling, like, I know desperate people do desperate things, right? To steal a trailer, gut it, burn it, they're going through something. And I knew it. So plus I needed to cast vision with our church because I don't want them to get discouraged. Oh my gosh, it's over. Right. We're done. I'm like, we're not done. God's just getting started. Are you kidding me? So we filmed this video on an old iPhone in this dusty, dirty yard in Council Bluffs that's got a bunch of our trailer and some other things that have been towed. I said, hey, this is our trailer. This is what happened. But understand something. Church is going to go forth. Man, we're having church this Sunday because the church was never, or the trailer was never the church. We're the church. And I don't care if there's no equipment. I don't care if there's no speakers. Doesn't matter. We're showing up. You're showing up. And I said, by the way, if you were part of this and you had something to do with this, man, we'd love you. We would love to meet you. I know desperate people do desperate things. I kind of made a joke at the end. I said, if you're watching this, show up at Meadows, leave the matches and gasoline at home. I made some comment, but we sent that video out and it just went, I don't know how many views it got, but it went crazy. Hmm. Like people were drawn to the story, but I got to be honest, Meredith, when I said that piece at the end about, oh, if you did this, you know, we'd love to have you at Meadows. I'm saying that because it's true, but in my heart, I'm thinking.
That'll never happen?
Never. No. I mean, number one, how would they ever see the video? Number two, it's a big city. And so I meant it, and I kind of say this almost embarrassingly to you, but in my heart, I'm like, that ain't going to happen. That's not going to happen. And then, it might have been a month later, we get a call from Guitar Center. These are guys that we've been connected to because we bought some equipment from them. And the guy says, there's a guy here and we think he's got your stuff, like our production equipment, you know, the expensive stuff that they would have taken out of the trailer. And we're like, what? What are the chances that they would even recognize our stuff? You know, a lot of that stuff is just everybody's got it. So they get the guy who pawns some of the stuff and they get the guy to come back the next day. And then he came back the next day to try to pawn some more stuff. And the police were waiting. They arrest the guy. And the police call me and they're like, hey, we got your stuff. We want to get it back to you. Some of the stuff that they didn't burn up. And I said, what can you tell me about the person that did it? And they're like, habitual criminal. This guy's been in and out of jail here, blah, blah, blah. And we hang up the phone and immediately I know in the depths of my heart, like, because I have no idea who this is. And I knew God is telling me, you need to go to that person. And here, another honest gut check moment. I didn't want to. Like, I'm like, I don't want to go. Like, that's intimidating. We get our stuff. Let's move on. But I remember the video. I'm like, I said, we want you to come to Meadows.
Holding yourself accountable.
Oh, my gosh. I was like, why did I do that video? but it took me time, you know, and finally I knew I got to do it. And it's crazy because we set up this visitation and I'm waiting there. And there, you know, it's a screen, you know, you're on a screen. Oh, and I'm looking at this empty chair and a cinder block wall behind it. And I'm thinking to myself, maybe he won't show up. You know, then I can tell the church, we tried. So because it's after the visitation time. And I'm like, I'm praying and I'm nervous because this guy doesn't know who I am. And all of a sudden, I can see the shadow and a guy sits down and I'm like, oh, boy, here we go. And this guy sits down. Big guy, tattoos on his arm. And I'm like, oh my gosh, here we go. Picks up the phone. He's like, yeah. And I'm like, yeah. So I'm like, Yeah, my name is Monty and I'm with Meadows Church. She's like, who? I'm Monty with Meadows Church, the church that I think you took our trailer. And immediately when he heard church and trailer, his countenance, like, you could see more of a somber, like he realized, oh, this is the church I stole from. And he goes, yeah. And I said, I just want to know what we can do to help. And as soon as I said that, I'm going to get emotional right now. As soon as I said that, this huge man starts sobbing in front of me. It's just quiet. And I'm watching him cry. And he starts to unpack this story. And I just knew it. He was an addict. And he's like telling me how, yeah, I've never committed a crime sober. I've been high since I've been, you know, 12, 14 years. I mean, just doing drugs for all of his life, living on the street. And this is his life. And it was just a miracle. So he starts just telling me his story. I start unpacking a story about a man named Jesus. And I tell him a little bit of my story. I said, if a God can save a man like me, I was so far from God. I said, he can do it with you. So I unpack the gospel for Michael. And in that moment, he surrenders his life to Christ. And my daughter is in the room, you know, because it's a video. So she's like looking at me. She's like,
can't believe this is happening.
Yes. it is so unbelievable what God is doing. Like it's like God is saying to me, Monty, your faith was so little. Like you said the right things, but you didn't believe it. If you only knew what I could do. And I'm like, oh my gosh, God, you're showing me. So Michael surrenders his life to Christ in the moment. And then we start to put something in place to get him out of there. So I'm calling his lawyer. We're doing whatever it takes to help this guy, trying to get him into a rehab because he's looking at a lot of time. Like, I mean, they're ready to just leave this guy in jail. I mean, this is his life. They know him in jail. And so I call his lawyer and his lawyer is so funny. He's like, I said, my name is Monty. I'm blah, 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 blah. And he's let me talk for like 2 minutes. He's like, who? Well, he goes, he's like, wait a minute. You're the pastor of the church. I said, yeah. He said, you're the victim. I said, I guess that's what you would call me. I've never thought of it that way, but yeah, I am. He said, I've been doing this 25, 30 years. He said, this is only the second time ever that I've ever heard the victim call back and want to do something for the person that harmed them or did something against them. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, well, I guess we're the second, but we want to do it. And we start fighting for Mike and we start saying, listen, we'll do whatever it takes and we'll pay money to get him out. We don't care. We want to get him into a rehab. We want to walk with this guy. There's hope. He's got Christ in him now, right? He's different. I know that. He surrendered his life to Christ and it happens. Mike gets out and Mike goes to a place called Open Door Mission, which is it's a mission or a place for guys to go to get back on their feet. It's also a recovery program. It's also Christ-based. And here we go. And I'll never forget Meredith the first time that Mike walked in the doors of Meadows Church. there the promise came true. The promise that God gave us that he's going to walk through the doors of Meadows Church. So yeah, so Mike is now coming to Meadows Church. He's serving on the host team. He's the guy that when you walk into Meadows, he's the face, the guy that's going to smile at you, the guy that's going to high five the kids, the guy that's going to give you a hug and tell you welcome home. Oh yeah, by the way, he's the guy that stole everything we had and burnt it to the ground. But God's in the business of rebuilding and God's in the business of restoring, renewing, making things new. It was a miracle in the making.
It was a miracle in the making, but the road was going to be bumpy. We'll be back with Michael's part of this story in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H Squared Leadership Institute.
Hi, I'm Habib Habib, and this is your inspirational minute. Once a farmer found an abandoned eagle's nest, and in it was an egg that was still warm. He took the egg back to his farm and laid it in the nest of one of his hens. The egg hatched and the baby eagle grew up along with the other chickens. It pecked around in the farmyard, scrabbling for grain. It spent its life within the yard and it rarely looked up. When it was very old, one day it lifted up its head and saw above it a wonderful sight, an eagle soaring high above the sky. Looking at it, the little eagle sighed and said to himself, "If only I had been born an eagle." The moral of the story, too often we live our lives imposing our own limitations on ourselves, not realizing the full extent of our God-given abilities. Most great accomplishments in history and in biblical stories have been achieved by ordinary people doing extraordinary things. You can do it too. Don't allow yourself to live a half-hearted life. Look up. Live a life of passion. Read more at HabibHabib.com.
And now part two of Monty and Michael's story.
Growing up, awesome family, awesome parents. I got three older brothers. I'm the youngest of four. There was no church in the home, though. We were not religious or by no means. Just your average family. Sixth grade summer, I started smoking weed. In that same summer, I was introduced to meth. Yeah, so I was 12 years old when I started my drug addiction. Just hanging out with the wrong people. I looked older, you know, for bigger than my age. I just got mixed up in a wrong crowd and started hanging out with the wrong people. And addiction grabbed a hold of me at 12 years old. Wow. And that baffled my parents. They didn't know what to do. And they didn't know the extent of it for the longest time. So I was skipping school. And that young, you couldn't have a job. So how was I to support my drug addiction? And I started stealing. I became very good at that. So seventh grade, I got expelled for drugs, went to an alternative school. You know, that place was just filled with drugs. So and I could get away with it a lot easier than, you know, there at this alternative school. And, you know, my parents were just baffled. So they're grounding me. They're taking me to the doctor to get drug tested. And, you know, of course, I failed every time, but I lied all the way up to then. And they would ask, you know, Michael, what are we doing wrong? What can we do to help? How can we help you? You know, and I didn't want the help. I wanted to go get high. So that's what I did. And during high school, it was just nonstop drugs. I mean, cocaine, meth, LSD. At 17, I had my first child, and I used that excuse to drop out of school. So that's when it was really got ugly. So anyway, I wasn't going to school no more, and I heavy drug use, heavy drug dealing. Had my second kid at 18, moved out of my parents at 18, got my own place, and then it was full-time dope dealer. My significant other at the time, you know, she wasn't a drug addict, didn't know what to do. You know, she stuck with it as much as she could. But I mean, I was a full-blown street thug by then. I loved guns. I loved drugs. I loved the fast life, fast money, adrenaline rush. There was times 2 a.m, I'd be walking through my apartment parking lot with an AK in my hand, you know, semi-automatic. I was insane. I remember when, she left me. The power was off. The food in the refrigerator was rotten, and I was sitting in the bedroom at the time. And she said, "I'm leaving. I'm taking the kids. I'm leaving." And I didn't handle that very well. So I was sitting on the bed with that assault rifle, thinking about taking my life. And she had called the cops, and the cops actually came and got me. And they took me to.
Mental health facility.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was in there for a few days and then, you know, right back to the races. 20 years old, I caught my first felony. And that was my first time in jail for a significant amount of time. I think I was in there for a few months. Dad ended up bonding me out. 20 to 27. So my first time in prison, I went to federal prison. But in between there, about a 7-year stint, I was I wreaked havoc on the community. I was selling dope, buying guns, stealing cars, burglarizing businesses. I was very bold. I didn't have any regards for the law or, you know, even my family or kids for that matter. I was just the streets was my family at the time, and that's it was just a vicious cycle. You know, I'd get caught for theft or possession, go into it, you know, I don't know how many treatment centers I've been in. I've done at least 4 inpatient treatment centers. I've done a few outpatient treatment centers. I've been in halfway houses, 3-quarter houses, sober living homes. Just a horrible life. So when I was 29, so I was having my 3rd kid by then with a different woman. I was at my parents' house messing around with a laser pointer, and I was drinking a beer. It was like midnight, and I finished my beer, and I go inside, and I get surrounded by Douglas County sheriffs saying, "Put the laser pointer down." I apparently had hit a plane 17 miles away.
Oh, my goodness.
With the laser pointer. So they put me in handcuffs. I didn't have any warrants or anything at the time, you know, and they had me in the back of the car, and I'm like, what are you guys arresting me for? And they're like, we don't know yet. So they ran my name. I didn't have any warrants. They let me go and said the FBI will be in contact with you. So I actually called my lawyer, Jim, and he's been my lawyer ever since my first conviction. I love the guy. He's done a lot for me, freelance too. But anyways, I told him what happened, and he goes, man, don't worry about it. It'll blow over. You know, you didn't know you were doing it, because it was midnight, and I didn't. The helicopter was coming from downtown, and I could see it from miles away, and I was still playing with it. And he come overhead, circled around a few times, and I was just enjoying my beer, playing. I had Star Wars going through my head, shooting stars, you know, with this green laser pointer. And sure enough, 3 months later, I get indicted for illuminating an aircraft. But that was, you know, a God thing there. And I'm oblivious to God. I
was going to ask you, had you ever cried out to God, ever thought about God?
Well, every time I got in trouble, it would, please God, get me out of this one, please God. But I never prayed. I've been to church a few times for funeral services. But, you know, I knew something was up there. Like, all this can't just be created from a boom, you know. Something made this. Something did all this. But I never thought of it past that. So usually I call my parents, cry and bond me out. But it was always, Lord, get me out of this one. You know, hey, I could do 2 or 10 years over this or whatnot. But so, yeah, I get indicted. But I was heavy into drugs and guns at that time. So that was, and what I meant by it was a God thing, it was God, like, all right, we're going to get him in trouble for this versus what he's doing. So we're going to yank him out of the streets. And when I got indicted, they tried doing, getting me for 10 years for, because I could have, involuntary manslaughter, I could have crashed a plane apparently. But the judge ended up hitting me in the middle. So I got 4 years in Leavenworth Penitentiary, 29. First time I ever been to prison. I had been in, and I've done a lot of county time before then, but I did a 4-year stint in Leavenworth Penitentiary, in Leavenworth, Kansas. You know, it's a federal prison. So it was very intimidating, you know, going in there and getting behind this 50-foot brick wall with, you know, guys doing life sentences for murder. And, you know, it was crazy being shackled up and walking into this prison basement. So I was like, man, this is it. I'm never doing drugs. I'm going to change now. Yeah, I'm going to change now. But I stayed sober throughout that whole time. And there's tons of alcohol and drugs in prison. You know, it's almost easier to get it in there. But I never touched stuff. So I did a lot of programming when I was in there, a lot of exercising, got in shape, got out of there. And then you go directly to a halfway house. So I did the halfway house, did great for a little bit of time, and then got back around the old people, places, and things. Got around the old friends, and then right back to the races. You know, in an addiction, you usually start right where you left off, if not worse. So there I was, right back to the streets, selling, you know, guns, drugs, stealing cars, stealing anything, not locked down. And back in jail. And I've been arrested probably 50 times in my life, 50, 60 times. So had my fourth kid, and roaming the streets, a good friend of mine, I went to his house actually and said, hey, I found this trailer in a hotel parking lot. It's a huge trailer. I'm going to need your help with it. He comes with me. We hook up to this trailer, and we take off, get to where we were going, and we open it up. So throughout all my years of theft, I've had people come to me, hey, I know where there's a bunch of lawn equipment or whatever in this garage on the cemetery grounds, or I know where this, we can go get all kinds of stuff out of this church, and you know, they're not locked up. And I've never knowingly, I was like, man, I got enough bad juju.
No cemeteries or churches.
Yeah, I you know,
you draw the line there.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. That'd be the one thing that I would never You know, I would never cross that line. And I didn't know Christ, but I still knew something was telling me to, you know, don't.
Still some conviction about it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I pick him up. We get to where we're going, hook up to this trailer, and we open the back. And I could see right away Meadows Church signs that was in the back of the trailer. And I looked at my buddy, and he said, "Mike, it's too late." You know, so we took everything out of this trailer, and it was everything the church owned, and took the DJ equipment out. I think that was the DJ equipment. There was a drum set, just like the electronics and stuff kept out, and everything else put back in, and took and burned it to the ground. Shortly after, you know, I sat on the stuff for a little while, and out of all the places, you know, didn't take it to a pawn shop. I didn't take it. For some reason, I was like, well, I'll just go to Guitar Center, thinking that, you know, it wouldn't be on the radar. And so they did. So the first time I went, they bought the speakers, cut me a check for the speakers, and said, our tech guy isn't in today, so we can't test this soundboard or whatever it was. You'll have to come back tomorrow when he's here, and we'll make sure it works, and then we'll cut you a check. So I was like, all right. So yeah, I left, went cashed the first check, and went and got some dope with it. And the next day, took everything out and take it inside. And they're like, all right, well, we got to have our guy test this stuff. So I'm like, all right, that's cool. They were like, go ahead, look around. And about 10 minutes goes by, and I'm like, man, something don't feel right. I go to the guy and I said, hey, everything cool, everything work? You know, I got a thing I got to be at, and, you know, in about a half hour, so I got to get out of here. They're like, oh yeah, we're almost done, man. Just give us 5 more minutes. And I'm looking at some guitars, and then I turn around, and then there's the cops. I'm like, man. So they're like, hey, you know, you trying to sell some equipment, you know? And I said, yeah. They're like, well, it may be stolen, and yada, yada. And I was like, man. I said, I'm going to jail. And they're like, no. It might be a misunderstanding. I said, no, man, I'm going to jail. So, yeah, they put handcuffs on me and stuck me in the back of the car. So I knew I was hit for that. I was on the run from my house getting raided, you know, months prior to that. I had one other. So there was a total of 4 1-20s, having priors in every single one they wanted me for. So ultimately, I could do 80 years. So
that's scary.
Yeah, it was scary. And I knew it was a wrap. That was the end of my life, pretty much. You know, I got 4 children, awesome family. Adriana, she's the mother of my youngest 2 children. We're engaged today. Just stuck with me for 12 years, and I drug her through hell. My family stuck with me, never gave up on me. And I knew all this was coming to a screeching halt. You know, I got away with a lot of stuff, but that church trailer is going to, I knew there was something up in the sky, and he was saying, well, you did it now, you know. So
what did you think when you had a visitor? Did you know who the visitor was? Did you know where he was from or anything?
So I'd been sitting in jail for, it'd been like a month went by or something like that. So I had gotten many of visits from detectives about my current charges, about other stuff they're questioning me about. So I bet you up before Monty came, I had probably a dozen video visits with detectives I've never saw in my life. So, Smith, you got a visit. And my heart dropped. I was like, man, more charges. And I go in there. I see Monty. And I'm like, yeah, another detective. You know, I sit down. And like he said, I was like, yeah, what's up? And he goes, well, Mike, you don't know me, but my name's Pastor Monty, and you stole our church trailer. And then my heart really dropped. I'm like, oh, you know, God's sending me to hell, and he's going to let me know right now, you know. And Monty asked, well, you know, what's your story? And I told him, I said, man, my whole life has been addiction. I never had a chance to grow up, you know, 12 years old, awesome family that cared for me, that loved me. I just resort to drugs. You know, I don't care about anything else. I don't care about my kids. I don't care about anything. I've been a junkie my whole life. He says, well, are you ready for some change? And I was like, I want to be in here for the rest of my life, you know? So I might as well try something. But like Monty said, you know, when he told me who he was, I started sobbing. I was like, my life's over. And now it's just going to pour salt on the wound to meet this pastor of this heinous crime that I did to him and his church. Because I never would have thought in a million years he was there, why he was there. So, you know, I go on to tell him that, you know, my story, addiction. And he asked me, you know, if I want some change, and would I be willing to give my life to Christ, and that Meadows would walk with me through my journey and you know, and fight for me and lead me to God's promises. And
what did you think? What did you feel when you heard that?
That's when the real pain set in. So it was surreal. I didn't believe it was happening. You know, I don't know. It was.
When you say real pain, so you're saying it hurts to hear that?
Well, to burn down, virtually burn down his church. And then this gentleman is saying, it's all right, we forgive you. That just the wash of emotion that went over me, you know, and I was like ugly crying. I was just, I couldn't believe it. And I said, yes, I'll give my life to Christ. And he like almost jumps out of his seat. He's like, holy cow, did this just happen? And at first I was like, all right, you know, okay, yes, I'll do it. He goes, all right, I'm going to send you in a Bible. I'm going to get you some Bible studies, literature. I'm going to send you in this stuff. And, you know, here's my number. And I think it cuts us off right then because you only get so much time. But I was able to get his number. When I left that room going out into the mod, I was like, man, this pastor just, and I'm telling these guys, and I'm trying to keep it together. I said, this pastor, this church that I burned down, just for, you know, offered me forgiveness and wants to try to change my life. I was like, maybe there is a God, you know, because how else? I mean, who does that? Who, you know, it was unheard of. So I get these Bibles and I get these work, you know, these Bible studies, and I jump right in because, again, I'm still facing 80 years. So I'm like, I got to deal with this somehow because I know my life's over. It's either get murdered in prison or, you know, why not try it? Let's see what happens. And I did. And I'm reading that Bible and I'm calling Monty every day because I'm scared. You know, I have a family. I miss my family. I'll never see my kids again. I'll never see my parents alive. Monty's telling me, you know, start with the, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, start in those books so you can kind of understand it. And he goes, whatever you do, Mike, don't give up hope. So, you know, I'm doing these studies and I'm reading scripture, and I've never before really opened up the Bible and actually read it. So, I mean, this is all new. I'm holding Bible studies.
In jail?
In jail.
I love this.
So, I'm calling Monty every day, and I got my ups and downs. You know, I got hope some days, and then I'll call him balling the next day. Like, I'm never getting out, Monty. And he's like, that doesn't matter. Just never give up hope. Trust in the Lord.
So, yeah, what's
so great. He's calling you every day.
Yeah, Mike's calling me every day. I'm like, you know, talk him off the ledge, pray with him every time, keep reminding him there's hope. But then I'm getting other calls, and it's from the jail, but it's not Mike. And it's these other guys. And
so you started handing out his number?
Yep.
I love that.
So Mike's, I'm like, dang, I got to get a staff. You know, I need some help. But it was awesome because he was so excited. He's opening up the gospel of Jesus Christ for the first time. Of course, that's alive and active, you know?
Right.
And Jesus is jumping off the page into Mike. And so he's telling these other guys, they're hopeless and they need hope. So, and they're getting in the word, and Mike's leading them in Bible studies. And it's just crazy. Hmm. I'm still getting calls today. Guys in Leavenworth that he was connected to. So it's pretty amazing. So yeah, it's crazy. And you know, to fast forward, we got Mike out. And I don't say God got Mike out. God gave Mike a second chance when he thought it was over.
So when I'm sitting in jail, when I got arrested for all that stuff, Monty's out there fighting for me. He, you know, I'm calling my lawyer, trying to contact him, see what's going on. And when I do get a hold of him, he's like, this pastor won't stop calling me. And so at this time, my family's washed their hands on me. My kids wouldn't answer my phone when
they're
I called
done,
from
huh?
them. Yep. So I had lost everything at that point. But Monty's fighting for me, and the judges are like, well, let's see where this goes. I get released to the Open Door Mission. So I met Monty for the first time. We were both nervous as heck, but I really 8 hours a day I'm in the Bible at the Open Door Mission because it's Bible-based. So, you know, I'm working on myself, working on getting in Scripture. You know, life was getting better. I was able to – it was a new set of eyes. I still was facing 80 years. I still had to go before judges and do all this, but I knew I was okay. If the Lord wanted me to minister in prison, that's where it was going to happen. Long story short, I'm reunited with my kids, so my life is getting better. The judge in Douglas County was like, all right, we're going to see where this goes. He goes, I'm going to give you restitution, time served.
When you heard time served, what did you feel?
It was a miracle. I mean, like, there's if Monty wouldn't have did what the Bible told him to do, what the Lord told him to do, the Lord wouldn't have worked with Monty, and, you know, and he wouldn't have came and visited me that day, I would still be in prison. I would have never had a chance for hope. If and when I ever did get out, I would have been a monster by then, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years in prison, and I probably would have died in there. So he came and seen me on like a Friday, but he goes, you're coming to church Sunday. And I'm like, you know, how could I tell him no? That was a roller coaster. So I'm about to go in front of this church and say, I'm the guy that did it. I remember, you know, halfway through the service. So Monty's up there doing the service, and I think I'm front row. And like halfway through, I get up and I leave. I'm like, I can't do this,
right?
You know? And one of the prayer warriors stopped me and was like, hey, I'm sorry we forgot to pray for you. You know, because I'm in tears. I'm like, I can't do this. And they're like, well, we're going to pray for you and give you strength. You know, I got my marbles back together. And, you know, Monty builds up to that story with the trailer. He goes, if we wouldn't have done what God told us to do, we couldn't give you Mike today. And I stand up, and the whole place uproars.
Went crazy.
Yeah, just clapping. And I mean, I'm like, I'm in tears, and me and Monty hug. It was amazing. But it never in a million years could you have gotten me up in front of the church and say, yeah, I'm the one that burned it, that, you know, mm-hmm. took everything and just torched it. Only God can give power like that, you know? So that was the beginning of life change. And it is. It wasn't all struggle. So I'm attending church. I've built fences my whole life. So I'm working for myself, and I'm just overdoing it. I'm getting, you know, I'm not in the Word as much anymore. I'm not working, you know, I'm not doing what God's telling me to do. I'm starting to take my own will back. So I'm in this halfway house, and I relapse. And when you're sobering up and you come to realize, you know, when you start thinking about someone else besides yourself, you know, I'm lifting up my family again, and they're getting hopes up again, and boom. You know, I made it by the skin of my teeth, only by the grace of God. I was able to get out and try to rebuild my life, and I'm back at it again.
So it was interesting. And 7 months in, I just noticed something was different. Like Mike was still showing up, but I just, like, something was amiss. And like, I didn't see the joy that I used to see. Like, he was used to be the first guy there, man. He was out there just on fire, and he was slower to serve and slower to get out there and slower to greet people. And then the day that I saw him, he used to sit towards the front with me, and then he was kind of sitting in the back. And I'm like, that's interesting. But the day we used to do a worship song at the end of service, and I saw Mike leave before the worship song more than once. And I'm like, that's not the Mike I know.
Not right.
That's not him. Like, you couldn't get him out of there. He was raising his hands. He was praising God. I didn't see that anymore. I saw a guy sitting in the back, and then I saw him leaving before church was even done. And soon he just stopped. He called one day and said, hey, I'm sick. I won't be there today. And I'm like, so that day I get done with church. I'm like, okay, got to check on Mike. Church is done. I call him, no answer. Okay, I leave a message. It's over. I mean, I'm calling him, texting him weekly, daily. I bet I sent him 30 texts, nothing. And I'm like, well, he's using. I mean, I know when you go silent and you go off the grid, he was using. So the church is praying, and not the whole church. We're not, but my leaders, we're gathering together. We're praying over Mike. We're praying over the situation. We're intercessing. God, come on, do something. But he is not answering me. I'm begging him, call me back. I'm not mad.
Right.
I love you. We'll do whatever we can. So he doesn't think, because guilt's going to set in.
Mike, were you listening to those voicemails? Were you reading the text messages?
I was avoiding them.
Uh-huh.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I was avoiding reading them. I'd see his name pop up, and I knew I felt horrible. I knew what I was doing was wrong. And this gentleman, after what I did, he's fighting for me, and I'm not doing my part. It made me feel...
You have guilt and shame going on, right?
Yeah.
So how did that come to a head?
I'm calling his daughter Alexis because she's fighting for him too. And I'm talking, Alexis, if you talk to your dad, she's like, no. And then Alexis comes in one day at church and shows me a picture. And it's a guy I don't even recognize. I'm like, I had to do a double take. I'm like, is that your dad? She's like, yeah. I mean, just a disheveled, in a month or maybe two. I don't even know. It was a month or two. Completely a different person, wearing orange, arrested again. So he was out using, Mike relapsed, got busted again. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, it was hard to get Mike off the first time. And now he's played the game with the drug court, played the game with the cops. And so I'm like, I got to go see him.
But at the point again, I'm thinking, well, now I'm definitely done.
This is it.
They're not going to give me another chance. I went through all this and I screwed up again and it's it. I called Monty. I called him and he goes, man, I'm so glad you're okay. He goes, we've been praying for you. And, he's like, this is okay. It's all right. Just God is good. God, just keep doing what we're doing. We'll get through this. And luckily, I didn't catch any more charges and drug court gave me another chance. I went back into another halfway house and it's been steadily just getting better. So I'm 10 months clean today. So this is the longest ever, willingly, but I'm in a sober living home right now, a wonderful place. So I run a Celebrate Recovery through Meadows. So I got a group of guys and I make myself realize, because, I'm kind of, you get stagnant a little bit, and it's because, you get what you put in, and I need to get in that word more. Because when I was at the Open Door Mission, I was in it 8 hours a day and I never felt more alive in my life. And I was on fire with the Holy Spirit, and people gravitated towards me and asked questions, and I'm like, I'm just this junkie off the street, but with God in my life, it was transforming me. So I realize now that I need to stay true into the word, and God gives me signs every day. So God's blessing me in so many ways.
It's amazing. Before we even started this podcast, Mike and I were talking, and I said, Mike, I started to keep a list of all the people that were connected, like through this story, people from Open Door Mission that Mike was doing life with there, people from jail, people in Mike's family. And I wish I would have been more diligent, but right now it's like 15 people that have surrendered their lives to Christ. Now it's more than that because I don't have an all-inclusive list, but all the people that have surrendered and become children of God, they're part of God's family now.
Because of Michael's influence.
Because of Mike's influence, because of that trailer, because of God. And it's like, I always tell Mike, you can burn our trailer any day, Just tell me first so I'm not quite so shocked when the cop shows up. But I tell you, it's just stuff. Who cares? We can buy more stuff. But you know what? When somebody's lost who comes home, like the prodigal son, we kill the fatted calf. We grab the robe. We grab the slippers. We grab the ring. And we celebrate. And we do celebrate. And we always say we're a church that we look less like a funeral, more like a party, because we got something to celebrate. Yeah. God is calling people home like Michael. And Mike's not out of the woods yet. I'm not out of the woods. I always say we're one decision away from throwing it all away. But you know what? We keep walking with Christ. We keep surrendering on a daily basis and saying, God, not my will, but yours. God's on the move. So Mike's leading a ministry. He said it, Celebrate Recovery. He leads a recovery ministry in the church. And that's just the beginning of what God has in store for this man. So we always say the best is yet to come. Amen, Mike?
Amen.
Yep.
Yeah.
Monty and Michael both talked about dreams of what God might want to do as this story continues. Their ultimate dream is starting a ministry to help felons, drug addicts, and people that have lost hope. They're even dreaming about starting a sober living home. One of the things we didn't get to share is how this story has impacted so many others, starting with Michael's family. For the first time in 40 years, Michael's dad went to church. He came to Meadows. He gave his heart to Jesus. When he became ill, Michael got to move home and help while he was on hospice, and he had the privilege of baptizing his dad. He's also baptized his daughter Alexis. His fiance came to Jesus. And you may remember there was another guy with Michael the day they stole the trailer. Not long ago, that guy walked through the doors at Meadows Church. At least 15 people have come to Christ because of Michael's influence, because of that trailer, because of God. Thanks to Monty and Michael for sharing their story. Hey, that video that Monty made the day after the trailer was stolen, it's really something to watch, especially when you know how the story unfolded. Head over to the Unfolding Podcast Facebook page if you'd like to watch it. Thanks to the team that makes The Unfolding possible. Producer Jason Rackow, social media help from Elena Nowlin, and special thanks to Jeremy and Jill Tracy for telling me about Michael and Monty's story. Thanks to our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H-Squared Leadership Institute. Find out how to unleash the full power of your leadership potential at HabibHabib.com. The Unfolding is produced by Northwestern Media, a ministry of the University of Northwestern St. Paul. We'll be back next week with another page in The Unfolding.